Nothing came of this request. There is no record that the VA conducted a psychological assessment of Hubbard. Throughout his life, however, questions would arise about his sanity. Russell Miller, a British biographer, tracked down an ex-lover of Hubbard's who described him as a manic depressive with paranoid tendencies. The woman, whom Miller called Barbara Kay, her real name was Barbara Clowden, later became a psychologist. She added, "He said he always wanted to found a religion like Moses or Jesus." A man who later worked in the church as Hubbard's medical officer, Jim Dincalcy, listed his traits. Paranoid personality, delusions of grandeur, pathological lying. Dr. Stephen Weissman, a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of British Columbia, who has been a prominent critic of Scientology, speculated that a possible diagnosis of Hubbard's personality would be malignant narcissism, which he characterizes as a highly insecure individual protecting himself with aggressive grandiosity, disavowal of any and every need from others, antisocial orientation, and a heady and toxic mix of rage, anger, aggression, violence, and paranoia. And yet, if Hubbard was paranoid, it was also true that he really was often pursued, first by creditors and later by grand juries and government investigators. He may have had delusions of grandeur, as so many critics say, but he did, in fact, make an undeniable mark on the world, publishing many bestsellers and establishing a religion that endures decades after his death. Grandiosity might well be a feature of a personality that could accomplish such feats. A fascinating glimpse into Hubbard's state of mind during this time is found in what I am calling his secret memoir. The church claims that the document is a forgery. It was produced by the former archivist for the Church of Scientology, Gerald Armstrong, in a 1984 suit that the church brought against him. Armstrong read some portions of them into the record over the strong objections of the church attorneys. Others later found their way onto the Internet. The church now maintains that Hubbard did not write this document, although when it was entered into evidence, the church's lawyers made no such representation, saying that the papers were intensely private, constitute a kind of self-therapy, and did not reflect Hubbard's actual condition. This disputed document has been called the affirmations or the admissions, but it is rather difficult to define. In part, the 30 pages constitute a highly intimate autobiography dealing with the most painful episodes in Hubbard's life. Many of the references to people and events made in these pages are supported by other documents. It appears that Hubbard is using techniques on himself that he would later develop into Dianetics. He explores memories that pose impediments in his mental and spiritual progress, and he prescribes affirmations or incantations to counter the psychological influence of these events. These statements would certainly be the most revealing and intimate disclosures Hubbard ever made about himself. There are three sections in this document, each of which seems to have a different purpose. The first section is called Course One. This is what I have termed the secret memoir, as it contains reflections on the most embarrassing or troubling features of Hubbard's biography. The purpose of this experiment is to reestablish the ambition, willpower, desire to survive, the talent and confidence of myself, Hubbard declares straightforwardly at the start. I was always anxious about people's opinion of me and was afraid I would bore them. This injected anxiety and careless speed into my work. I must be convinced that I can write skillfully and well. Those who criticize his work are fools, he writes. I must be convinced I have succeeded in writing and with ease will regain my popularity, which actually was not small. My service record was none too glorious, he admits. He also confesses his shame about his frequent affairs. but he is intent on succeeding in his relationship with Sarah, whom he describes as young, beautiful, desirable. Unfortunately, he is handicapped by bouts of impotence. I want her always, but I am 13 years older than she. She is heavily sexed. My libido is so low I hardly admire her naked. Sex preoccupies him. He's worried about his very bad masturbatory history, his sexual diseases, and his impotence, which he'd been treating with testosterone supplements. By eliminating certain fears of hypnosis, curing my rheumatism, and laying off hormones, I hope to restore my former libido. I must. Through self-hypnosis, he hopes to convince himself of certain prescriptive mantras, including, I can write. My mind is still brilliant. That masturbation was no sin or crime. That I do not need to have ulcers anymore. That I am fortunate in losing Polly and my parents, for they never meant well by me. That I believe in my gods and spiritual things. That my magical work is powerful and effective. That the numbers 7, 25, and 16 are not unlucky or evil for me. That I am not bad to look upon. That I am not susceptible to colds. That Sarah is always beautiful to me. That these words and commands are like fire and will sear themselves into every corner of my being, making me happy and well and confident forever. The second part of the document, labeled Course 2, included the statements that have come to be called affirmations, although Hubbard refers to them as incantations. He had recently gotten a new recorder for dictation called a soundscriber. It may be that he recorded this portion and played it back to himself as a means of self-hypnosis. This section begins with the command, "You are asleep." In this lesson, Hubbard tells himself, he will learn several important things. You have no urge to talk about your Navy life. You do not like to talk of it. You never illustrate your point with bogus stories. It is not necessary for you to lie to be amusing and witty. You like to have your intimate friends approve of and love you for what you are. This desire to be loved does not amount to a psychosis. You can sing beautifully. Nothing can intervene between you and your guardian. She cannot be displaced because she is too powerful. She does not control you. She advises you. You will never forget these incantations. They are holy and are now become an integral part of your nature. Material things are yours for the asking. Men are your slaves. You are not sleepy or tired, ever. Your guardian alone can talk to you as you sleep, but she may not hypnotize you. Only you can hypnotize yourself. The desires of other people have no hypnotic effect on you. Nothing, no one, opposes your writing. You can carry on a wild social life and still write 100,000 words a month or more. Your writing has a deep hypnotic effect on people. You will make fortunes writing. Your psychology is advanced and true and wonderful. It hypnotizes people. It predicts their emotions, for you are their ruler. You will live to be 200 years old. You will always look young. You have no doubts about God. You are not a coward. Your eyes are getting progressively better. They became bad when you used them as an excuse to escape the Naval Academy. You have no reason to keep them bad. Your stomach trouble you used as an excuse to keep the Navy from punishing you. You are free of the Navy. Your hip is a pose. You have a sound hip. It never hurts. Your shoulder never hurts. Your foot was an alibi. The injury is no longer needed. Testosterone blends easily with your own hormones. You have no fear of what any woman may think of your bed conduct. You know you are a master. You know they will be thrilled. You can come many times without weariness. Many women are not capable of pleasure in sex, and anything adverse they say or do has no effect whatever upon your pleasure. You have no fear if they conceive. What if they do? You do not care. Pour it into them and let fate decide. You can tell all the romantic tales you wish, but you know which ones were lies. You have enough real experience to make anecdotes forever. Stick to your true adventures. Money will flood in upon you. Self-pity and conceit are not wrong. Your mother was in error. Masturbation does not injure or make insane. Your parents were in error. Everyone masturbates. The most thrilling thing in your life is your love and consciousness of your guardian. She has copper-red hair, long braids, a lovely Venusian face, a white gown belted with jade squares. She wears gold slippers. You can talk with her and audibly hear her voice above all others. You can do automatic writing whenever you wish. You do not care what comes out on the paper when your guardian dictates. The red-haired guardian Hubbard visualizes so vividly is a kind of ideal mother who also functions as his muse and is the source of his astoundingly rapid writing. Hubbard loves her but reassures himself that his guardian does not control him. In all things, he is the controlling force. She seems to be an artifact of the influence of Aleister Crowley. Jack Parsons had said that Hubbard called his guardian the Empress. His fear of hypnotism is quite striking. He was an accomplished stage hypnotist, a skill he displayed at a meeting of a group of sci-fi fans in Los Angeles when he put nearly everyone in the audience into a trance and persuaded one of them that he was holding a pair of miniature kangaroos in the palm of his hand. He also once tried to hypnotize Sarah's mother after she had a stroke, to persuade her to leave her money to him. But then he would accuse Sarah of hypnotizing him in his sleep. If one looks behind the affirmations to the conditions they are meant to correct, one sees a man who is ashamed of his tendency to fabricate personal stories, who is conflicted about his sexual needs, and who worries about his mortality. He has a predatory view of women, but at the same time fears their power to humiliate him. The third and final section of this document is titled The Book. It contains a checklist of personal goals and compliments he pays to himself, but it is also a portrait of the Superman that he wishes to be. He does make mention of an actual book. He calls it One Commandment, that seems to be a reference to Excalibur. It freed you forever from the fears of the material world and gave you material control over people, he writes. You are radiant like sunlight. You can read music. You are a magnificent writer who has thrilled millions. Ability to drop into a trance state at will. Lack of necessity of following a pulp pattern. You did a fine job in the Navy. No one there is now out to get you. You are psychic. You do not masturbate. You do not know anger. Your patience is infinite. Snakes are not dangerous to you. There are no snakes in the bottom of your bed. You believe implicitly in God. You have no doubts of the All-Powerful. You believe your guardian perfectly. The judge in the Armstrong suit where this document was presented as evidence offered his own amateur diagnosis of Hubbard's personality in a crushing decision against the church. The organization is clearly schizophrenic and paranoid, and this bizarre combination seems to be a reflection of its founder, L.R.H. The evidence portrays a man who has been virtually a pathological liar when it comes to his history, background, and achievements. The writings and documents in evidence additionally reflect his egoism, greed, avarice, lust for power, and vindictiveness and aggressiveness against persons perceived by him to be disloyal or hostile. At the same time, it appears that he is charismatic and highly capable of motivating, organizing, controlling, manipulating, and inspiring his adherents. Obviously, he is and has been a very complex person, and that complexity is further reflected in his alter ego, the Church of Scientology. In 1948, 10 years after his first attempt to establish himself as a screenwriter, Hubbard had returned to Hollywood, setting up shop as a freelance guru. I went right down in the middle of Hollywood, I rented an office, got hold of a nurse, wrapped a towel around my head, and became a swami, Hubbard later said. I used to sit in my penthouse on Sunset Boulevard and write stories for New York, and then go to my office in the studio and have my secretary tell everybody I was in conference while I caught up on my sleep, he recalled on another occasion. He painted a far different picture in a letter to the Veterans Administration, which was demanding reimbursement for an overpayment. I cannot imagine how to repay this $51, as I am nearly penniless and have but $28.50 to last me for nearly a month to come, he writes. My expenditures consist of $27 a month trailer rent and $80 a month food for my wife and self, which includes gas, cigarettes, and all incidentals. I am very much in debt and have not been able to get a job. Instead of repaying the VA, he boldly asks for a loan. In Hollywood, Hubbard began perfecting techniques that he first developed in the Naval Hospital and that later became Dianetics. He boasts to Hayes, "Been amusing myself making a monkey out of Freud. I always knew he was nutty, but didn't have a firm case." He adds that he has been conducting research on inferiority complexes. "Nightly had people writhing in my Hollywood office, sending guys out twice as tall as Superman." For the first time, he floats the idea of a book which he tentatively titles An Introduction to Traumatic Psychology. He thinks it will require about 6 weeks to write. "I got to revolutionize this here field because nobody in it, so far as I can tell, knows his anatomy from a gopher hole." Hubbard was casting around for a new direction in his life. He took up acting at the Geller Theater Workshop, paid for in part by the VA, but that didn't satisfy him. There was a larger plan stirring in his imagination. "I was hiding behind the horrible secret, and that is I was trying to find out what the mind was all about," he recalls. "I couldn't even tell my friends. They didn't understand. They said, 'Here's Hubbard. He's leading a perfectly wonderful life. He gets to associate with movie actresses. He knows hypnotism and so has no trouble with editors. He has apartments and stuff.'" It was the larval stage of Hubbard's astonishing transformation, from the depressed, rejected, impoverished, creatively exhausted figure he paints in the affirmations, to his nearly overnight success as a thinker and founder of an international movement when his book Dianetics was finally published. He wrote his friend Robert Heinlein, "I will soon, I hope, give you a book risen from the ashes of the old Excalibur, which details in full the mathematics of the human mind, solves all the problems of the ages, and gives 6 recipes for aphrodisiacs, and plays the mouth organ with the left foot. He writes a little about recovering from the war, then remarks, "The main difficulty these days is getting sane again. I find out that I am making progress. Of course, there is always the danger that I will get too sane to write." He is angling for a Guggenheim grant for his book on psychology. Meantime, he was so pressed financially that he begged Heinlein for a loan of $50. "Golly, I never was so many places in print with less to show for it," Hubbard complained. "I couldn't buy a stage costume for Gypsy Rose Lee." Hubbard was writing these letters from Savannah, Georgia, in the waning days of 1948 and the spring of 1949. He said he was volunteering in a psychiatric clinic at St. Joseph's Medical Center, getting case histories at the request of the American Psychiatric Association. It is a shadowy period in his life, but it was in Savannah that he began to sketch out the principles that would form the basis of his understanding of the human mind. He claimed to be getting phenomenal results on nearly every malady he addressed. "One week ago, I brought in my first asthma cure," he writes to Heinlein. "I have an arthritis to finish tomorrow, and so it goes." It's unclear whether Hubbard himself was receiving treatment in Savannah. "My hip and stomach and side are well again," he writes to Heinlein, adding that he is straightening out the kinks that have held down production on the money machine. In his letters, Hubbard continually speculates about the book he hopes to finish soon. "It ain't agin religion," he boasts to Heinlein. "It just abolishes it. It's science, boy, science." He makes a vague reference to the research he's performing on children. "This hell broth I cooked up works remarkably well on kids," he remarks. "Took a scared little kid that was supposed to be stupid and was failing everything and worked on him about 35 hours just to make sure. That was last month. So now he turns up this afternoon with all A's and all of a sudden reading Shakespeare." He was also noting improvement in himself, both in his work and in his recovered sexual powers. "I am cruising on 4 hours sleep a night. But the most interesting thing is I'm up to 8 cums. In an evening, that is." Heinlein was eager for details. Hubbard responded by outlining what he would later call the tone scale. It describes the range of human emotional states from 1 to 4. At bottom, there is apathy, then anger. These lower tones were governed by the unconscious, which Hubbard says should be called the reactive mind. The third level, which was as yet untitled, is the normal state for most of humanity. And the fourth is a condition of happiness and industriousness. Hubbard's experimental technique aimed at raising an individual out of the lower tones and into the superior state of the fourth tone. His method, as he described it to Heinlein, was to drain off the painful experiences and associations that an individual has accumulated in his lifetime. Once that's done, astonishing results take place. Asthma, headaches, arthritis, menstrual cramps, astigmatism, and ulcers simply disappear. There is a huge boost in competence. The reactive mind is eliminated, and the rational mind takes over. At the end of April 1949, Hubbard sent a note to Heinlein that he was moving to Washington, D.C. for an indefinite stay. There was no word about Sarah. 3 weeks later, the 38-year-old Hubbard applied for a license in Washington to marry 26-year-old Ann Jensen. The application was canceled the next day at the request of the bride. Perhaps she had learned that Hubbard was already married to his second wife and had previously committed bigamy. In any case, Ann Jensen's name disappears from Hubbard's life story. He and Sarah moved to Elizabeth, New Jersey, where John Campbell, Hubbard's editor at Astounding Science Fiction before the war, resided. Campbell visited Hubbard often and became one of his first and most important converts. "Damn it, the man's got something, and something big," he wrote excitedly to Heinlein. Campbell underwent the treatment, which employed deep hypnosis. In that entranced state, Campbell was able to retrieve traumatic memories of his birth. "I was born with a cord wrapped round my neck, strangling me," he recounted to Heinlein. The doctor who delivered him, whom Campbell now remembered had a German accent, had barked at Campbell's mother, saying, "You must stop fighting. You are killing him. Relax." Later, the doctor put some corrosive medication in the baby's eyes and said, "You'll forget all about this in a little while." Campbell characterized these instructions as unshakable post-hypnotic commands of tremendous force, which governed much of his subsequent behavior. "The neighbor bratlings could tease me unmercifully, and did, because I couldn't fight," he told Heinlein. His mother would often attempt to console him by telling him that he would forget the painful experiences of his childhood soon enough, with the result that many of the most important moments of his life were lost to him. "Ron's technique consists of bringing these old memories into view and then erasing the memory," Campbell explained. He writes that although he now doesn't remember his actual birth, he does remember retrieving it and relating it to Hubbard, who then erased the real memory with its painful associations, leaving Campbell with the experience of knowing what happened to him without actually having the memory continue its sinister influence. Obviously, the line between a real memory and an implanted one, or a confabulation, was very difficult to draw. "This was the most potent medicine ever discovered," Campbell continued, "but also the most dangerous weapon imaginable if not properly handled. With the knowledge I now have, I could turn most ordinary people into homicidal maniacs within 1 hour." And yet, as an editor, Campbell recognized the commercial possibilities. "This is the greatest story in the world, far bigger than the atomic bomb." He added in a postscript that he had also lost 20 pounds in 25 days, another commercial bonanza. Campbell was beside himself because Hubbard had yet to actually start writing the book. "The key to world sanity is in Ron Hubbard's head, and there isn't even an adequate written record." In December, Ron and Sarah moved into what Hubbard termed a little old shack in Bayhead, New Jersey, with 8 bedrooms near the beach. In March 1950, he sent the Heinleins a handmade miniature book catalog from Hubbard House Publishers, proclaiming the spring collection, announcing a new Hubbard edition, completely new material, not a revision. Co-authors Ron and Sarah Hubbard. Release date March 8, 50, 11:50 a.m. Weight 9 pounds, 2 ounces. Height 21 inches. Alexis Valerie has received rave notices from all reviewers. Alexis was the image of her father, who delighted in her precociousness. "Ron is going at a little less than the speed of light all day and every day," Sarah wrote to the Heinleins. "Then, in the middle of the night, he goes in and tells Alexis all about it." Ron promised to send Heinlein a galley of Dianetics as soon as it was available. He reported that it was 180,000 words, begun January 12, 50, finished February 10, off the press by April 25. When one of his followers asked Hubbard how he had been able to dash it off so quickly, Hubbard said that his guardian spirit, the Empress, had dictated it to him. Like several other prominent sci-fi writers of the Golden Age, including Heinlein and A.E. Van Vogt, Hubbard had been strongly influenced by the writings of Alfred Korzybski, a Polish-American philosopher who created the theory of general semantics. In New Jersey, Sarah read Korzybski and quoted several passages aloud to Ron, who immediately grasped the ideas as the basis for a system of psychology, if not for a whole religion. Korzybski pointed out that words are not the things they describe, in the same way that a map is not the territory it represents. Language shapes thinking, creating mental habits, which can stand in the way of sanity by preserving delusions. Korzybski argued that emotional disturbances, learning disorders, and many psychosomatic illnesses, including heart problems, skin diseases, sexual disorders, migraines, alcoholism, arthritis, even dental cavities, could be remedied by semantic training, much as Hubbard would claim for his own work. He cited Korzybski frequently, although he admitted that he could never get through the texts themselves. Bob Heinlein sat down one time and talked for 10 whole minutes on the subject of Korzybski to me, and it was very clever, he later related. I know quite a bit about Korzybski's works. From this second-hand knowledge, Hubbard saw the need for creating a special vocabulary which would allow him to define old thoughts in new ways. The soul becomes a thetan, for instance. Or invent new words such as enturbulate, confuse, and hatting, training. Or use words and phrases in a novel manner, such as turning adjectives or verbs into nouns, or vice versa. An overt, a static, alterisness. Plus a Pentagon-level glut of acronyms, all of which would entrap his followers in a self-referential semantic labyrinth. Hubbard granted his friend and acolyte John Campbell a scoop by letting him buy a lengthy excerpt of his forthcoming book. Thus the world got its first look at Dianetics in the pages of Astounding Science Fiction. This article is not a hoax, joke, or anything but a direct, clear statement of a totally new scientific thesis, Campbell warns his readers, who might be confused by finding a work of scholarship in a pulp magazine. I know Dianetics is one of, if not the greatest discovery, of all man's written and unwritten history, he wrote to a puzzled contributor. It produces the sort of stability and sanity men have dreamed about for centuries. He assured a young writer that Hubbard would win the Nobel Peace Prize for his work. The book itself, Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, appeared in May. It was completely unexpected, given Hubbard's history as a writer. He intended it to stand as a capstone to the 50,000 years of thinking men without whose speculations and observations the creation and construction of Dianetics would not have been possible. In Scientology, Dianetics is known as Book One. With 18 million copies sold, it is indisputably the most widely read and influential book on the human mind ever published, the church maintains. Scientology dates its own calendar from 1950, the year Dianetics was published. Hubbard's theory is that the mind has two parts. The analytical, or conscious mind, is the center of awareness, the storehouse of all past perceptions. Nothing is lost from its data banks. Every smell or pattern or sound attached to one's previous experiences is present and capable of being completely recaptured. This is the mind that observes and thinks and solves problems. It is rational and aware of itself. The other form of mentality is the reactive mind. It is the single source of nightmares, insecurity, and unreasonable fears. It doesn't think. It is a repository of painful and destructive emotions, which are recorded even while an individual is sleeping or unconscious or still in the womb. The recording is not the same as a memory in the sense of being a mental construct. It is physically a part of the cellular structure and capable of reproducing itself in generations of new cells. Cells are evidently sentient in some currently inexplicable way, Hubbard speculates. When awakened by some stimulus, the recording, Hubbard calls it an engram, turns off the conscious mind and seizes control of an individual's actions or behavior. Hubbard compares the engram to a post-hypnotic suggestion. He describes a man in a trance who has been told that every time the operator touches his tie, the subject will remove his coat. When the subject is awakened, he is not consciously aware of the command. The operator then touches his tie, Hubbard writes. The subject may make some remark about its being too warm and so take his coat off. This can be done repeatedly. At last, the subject may become aware from the expressions on people's faces that something is wrong. He will not know what is wrong. He will not even know that the touching of the tie is the signal which makes him take off his coat. The hypnotic command in his unconscious continues to govern his behavior even when the subject recognizes that it is irrational and perhaps harmful. In the same way, Hubbard suggests, engrams work their sinister influence on everyday actions, undermining one's self-confidence and subverting rational behavior. The individual feels helpless as he engages in behavior he would never consciously consent to. He is handled like a marionette by his engrams. Although there were no recorded case histories to prove his claim that hundreds of patients had been cured through his methods, through many years of exact research and careful testing, Hubbard offered appealing examples of hypothetical behavior. For instance, a woman is beaten and kicked. She is rendered unconscious. In that state, she is told she is no good, a faker, and that she is always changing her mind. Meantime, a chair has been knocked over. A faucet is running in the kitchen. A car passes outside. All of these perceptions are parts of the engram. The woman is not aware of it, but whenever she hears running water or a car passing by, the engram is partly re-stimulated. She feels discomfort if she hears them together. If a chair happens to fall as well, she experiences a shock. She begins to feel like the person she was accused of being while she was unconscious, a fickle, no-good faker. This is not theory, Hubbard repeatedly asserts. It is an exact science that represents an evolutionary step in the development of man. Hubbard proposed that the influence engrams have over one's current behavior can be eliminated by reciting the details of the original incident until it no longer possesses an emotional charge. Footnote. A conspicuous example of Dianetic processing involved John Brody, the outstanding quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, who suffered an injury to his throwing arm in 1970 that threatened to end his career. Despite the best medical attention and physical therapy, his elbow remained sore and swollen. Finally, he went to Phil Spickler, a Scientologist and Dianetic auditor, who asked Brody to tell him about previous incidents that might be keeping his arm from healing. Brody related that he had been in a severe traffic accident in 1963 in which his arm had been broken. As he explored the incident with Spickler, Brody seemed to recall one of the ambulance attendants saying, "Well, that poor son of a bitch will never throw a football again." And yet Brody was unconscious at the time. How could he have such a memory? Spickler told him this was all part of an engram that was keeping him from getting well. The ambulance attendant's prediction had been simmering away in my unconscious for 7 years, agitating all my deepest fears of declining ability or failure, Brody later writes. It had finally surfaced as this psychosomatic ailment in my throwing arm. Phil made me tell the story again and again and again until no charge showed on the E-meter. John Brody and James D. Houston, Open Field, page 166. The swelling on Brody's arm diminished. He went on to have one of the greatest seasons of his career and was voted the National Football League's most valuable player that year. End of footnote. Dianetics deletes all the pain from a lifetime, Hubbard writes. When this pain is erased in the engram bank and refiled as memory and experience in the memory banks, all aberrations and psychosomatic illnesses vanish. The object of Dianetics therapy is to drain the engrams of their painful, damaging qualities and eliminate the reactive mind entirely, leaving a person clear. Written in a bluff, quirky style, and overrun with patronizing footnotes that do little to substantiate its bold findings, Dianetics nonetheless became a sensation, lodging itself for 28 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and laying the groundwork for the category of post-war self-help books that would seek to emulate its success. Hundreds of Dianetics groups sprang up around the United States and in other countries in order for its adherents to apply the therapeutic principles Hubbard prescribed. One only needed a partner, called an auditor, who could guide the subject to locate his engrams and bring them into consciousness, where they would be released and rendered harmless. "You will find many reasons why you cannot get well," Hubbard warns, but he promises, "Dianetics is no solemn adventure. For all that it has to do with suffering and loss, its end is always laughter." So foolish, so misinterpreted, were the things which caused the woe. The book arrived at a moment when the aftershocks of the World War were still being felt. Behind the exhilaration of victory, there was immense trauma. Religious certainties were shaken by the development of bombs so powerful that civilization, if not life itself, became a wager in the Cold War contest. Loss, grief, and despair were cloaked by the stoicism of the age, but patients being treated in mental hospitals were already on the verge of outnumbering those being treated for any other cause. Psychoanalysis was suspiciously viewed in much of America as a European, mainly Jewish, import, which was time-consuming and fantastically expensive. Hubbard promised results in less than 20 hours of work that would be superior to any produced by several years of psychoanalysis. The profession of psychiatry, meantime, had entered a period of brutal experimentation, characterized by the widespread practice of lobotomies and electroshock therapy. The prospect of consulting a psychiatrist was accompanied by a justified sense of dread. That may have played a role in Hubbard's decision not to follow up on his own request for psychiatric treatment. The appearance of a do-it-yourself manual that claimed to demystify the secrets of the human mind and produce guaranteed results, for free, was bound to attract an audience. It was sweepingly, catastrophically successful, Hubbard marveled. The scientific community, stupefied by the book's popularity, reacted with hostility and ridicule. It seemed to them little more than psychological folk art. "This volume probably contains more promises and less evidence per page than has any publication since the invention of printing," the Nobel physicist Isidore Isaac Rabie wrote in his review of Dianetics for Scientific American. The huge sale of the book, to date, is distressing evidence of the frustrated ambitions, hopes, ideals, anxieties, and worries of the many persons who, through it, have sought succor. Erich Fromm, one of the predominant thinkers of the psychoanalytic movement, denounced the book as being expressive of a spirit that is exactly the opposite of Freud's teachings. Hubbard's method, he complains, has no respect for and no understanding of the complexities of personality. He derisively quotes Hubbard, "In an engineering science like Dianetics, we can work on a push-button basis." But of course, that was part of the theory's immense appeal. One of the most painful reviews of Dianetics, no doubt, was by Korzybski's most notable intellectual heir, and later U.S. Senator from California, S.I. Hayakawa. He not only dismissed the book, he also criticized what he saw as the spurious craft of writing science fiction. "The art consists in concealing from the reader, for novelistic purposes, the distinctions between established scientific facts, almost established scientific hypotheses, scientific conjectures, and imaginative extrapolations far beyond what has even been conjectured," he wrote. The writer who produces too much of it, too fast, and too glibly, runs the risk of believing in his own creations. It appears to me inevitable that anyone writing several million words of fantasy and science fiction should ultimately begin to internalize the assumptions underlying the verbiage. Dianetics, Hayakawa noted, was neither science nor fiction, but something else. Fictional science. Not all scientists rejected Hubbard's approach. One of his early supporters was Campbell's brother-in-law, Dr. Joseph Winter, a physician who had also written for Astounding Science Fiction. Searching for a more holistic approach to medicine, Winter traveled to New Jersey to experience Hubbard's method firsthand. While listening to Hubbard running one of his patients, or while being run myself, I would find myself developing unaccountable pains in various portions of my anatomy or becoming extremely fatigued and somnolent, he reported. I had nightmares of being choked, of having my genitalia cut off, and I was convinced that Dianetics as a method could produce effects. Hubbard's method involved placing the patient in a state of reverie, achieved by giving the command, "When I count from 1 to 7, your eyes will close." A tremble of the lashes as the eyelids flutter shut signals that the subject has fallen into a receptive condition. "This is not hypnotism," Hubbard insists. "Although a person in a Dianetic reverie may appear to be in a trance, the opposite is the case," he says. "The purpose of therapy is to awaken a person in every period of his life when he has been forced into unconsciousness. Dianetics wakes people up." Sarah watched the effect that Ron was having on his patients. "He would hold hands with them and try to talk them into these phony memories," she recalled. "He would concentrate on them, and they loved it. They were so excited about someone who would just pay this much attention to them." Dr. Winter tried out Hubbard's techniques on his 6-year-old son, who was afraid of the dark because he was terrified of being choked by ghosts. Winter asked him to remember the first time he saw a ghost. "He has on a long white apron, a little white cap on his head, and a piece of white cloth on his mouth," the boy said. He even had a name for the ghost. It happened to be the same as that of the obstetrician who delivered him. Winter then asked his son to look at the ghost in his mind repeatedly until the boy began to calm down. When the maximum relaxation had apparently been obtained after 10 or 12 recountings, "I told him to open his eyes," Winter reported. "It has been over a year since that short session with my son, and he has not had a recurrence of his fear of the dark in all that time." The idea that early memories, even prenatal ones, could be recaptured was central to Hubbard's theory. Every engram rooted in the reactive mind has its predecessors. The object of Dianetics therapy is to hunt down the original insult, the basic, which produced the engram in the first place. Freud had also postulated that childhood traumas would be played out in later life through symptoms of hysteria or neurosis. In his famous Wolfman case, for instance, Freud traced a childhood neurosis in his patient to the sight of his parents copulating when he was a year and a half old. Everything goes back to the reproduction of scenes, Freud thought at the time. He recognized that in many cases such childhood memories were clearly invented, but from an analytical perspective they were still useful because the emotions and associations attached to the confabulations opened a window onto the patient's subconscious. False childhood memories were often as deeply believed in as real ones, but what made them stand apart from actual memories was that they were almost always the same, unvarying from patient to patient. They must be somehow universal. Freud's protege Carl Jung would seize on this fact to construct his theory of the collective unconscious. Freud himself came to believe that what was a false memory in a present-day patient's mind had been a reality at some point in prehistory. It seems to me quite possible that all the things that are told to us today in analysis as fantasy, the seduction of children, the inflaming of sexual excitement by observing parental intercourse, the threat of castration, were once real occurrences in the primeval times of the human family, and that children in their fantasies are simply filling in the gaps in individual truth with prehistoric truth. And yet Freud continued to be troubled by the fact that many of these supposed memories were formed at a suspiciously early age. The extreme achievement on these lines is a fantasy of observing parental intercourse while one is still an unborn baby in the womb, he noted wryly. That absurdity was one of the reasons he eventually cast aside the seduction theory. For Hubbard, however, early or even prenatal traumas were literally true. He believed that the fetus not only recorded details of his parents copulating during his pregnancy, but also every word spoken during the act. Such recordings can be re-stimulated in adult life by hearing similar language, which would then awaken the anxiety that the fetus experienced during a violent sexual episode, for instance. That could lead to aberration, which for Hubbard includes all psychoses, neuroses, compulsions, and any other deviation from rational behavior. Engrams form chains of similar incidents, Hubbard suggests. He gives the example of 17 prenatal engrams found in a single individual who had passed for normal for 36 years of his life. Among them, coitus chain, father. First incident, zygote. 56 succeeding incidents. Two branches, father drunk and father sober. Coitus chain, lover. First incident, embryo. 18 succeeding incidents, all painful because of enthusiasm of lover. Fight chain. First incident, embryo. 38 succeeding incidents. Three falls, loud voices, no beating. Attempted abortion, surgical. First incident, embryo. 21 succeeding incidents. Attempted abortion, douche. First incident, fetus. Two incidents, one using paste, one using Lysol, very strong. Masturbation chain. First incident, embryo. 80 succeeding incidents. Mother masturbating with fingers, jolting child and injuring child with orgasm. And so on, all leading up to birth, instrument, 29 hours labor. Hubbard's view of women, as revealed in this and many other examples, is not just contemptuous. It betrays a kind of horror. He goes on to make this amazing statement. It is a scientific fact that abortion attempts are the most important factor in aberration. The child on whom the abortion is attempted is condemned to live with murderers, whom he reactively knows to be murderers, through all his weak and helpless youth. In his opinion, it is very difficult to abort a child, which is why the process so often fails. 20 or 30 abortion attempts are not uncommon in the aberree, and in every attempt the child could have been pierced through the body or brain, Hubbard writes. However many billions America spends yearly on institutions for the insane and jails for the criminals are spent primarily because of attempted abortions done by some sex-blocked mother to whom children are a curse, not a blessing of God. One of the charges that would be lobbed against Hubbard by his disaffected eldest son was that his father had attempted 2 abortions on his mother. One I observed when I was around 6 or 7, L. Ron Hubbard, Jr. later testified. He recalled seeing his father standing over his mother with a coat hanger in his hand. The other attempted abortion was upon himself. I was born at 6.5 months and weighed 2 pounds, 2 ounces. I mean, I wasn't born. This is what came out as a result of their attempt to abort me. Hubbard himself writes in his secret memoir that Polly was terrified of childbirth, but conceived, despite all precautions, 7 times in 5 years, resulting in 5 abortions and 2 children. While he was writing Dianetics, and Sarah was pregnant with Alexis, she says, Hubbard kicked her in the stomach several times to attempt to cause a miscarriage. Later, Hubbard told one of his lovers that he himself had been born of an attempted abortion. While Hubbard was still writing Dianetics, he contacted both the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association, representing himself as a colleague who had made fundamental advances in the science. Patients placed in a trance state, he explained, could be guided to remember their own births. In 16 of what he says were the 20 cases that he examined, psychosomatic illnesses had been caused by pre-birth or birth traumas. Migraine, headache, ulcers, asthma, sinusitis, and arthritis were among those illnesses relieved, he asserted. In a similar letter to the American Gerontological Society, he also claimed that 16 of the 20 cases had been made measurably younger. His preliminary title for the work was Certain Discoveries and Researches Leading to the Removal of Early Traumatic Experiences, Including Attempted Abortion, Birth Shock, and Infant Accidents and Illnesses, with an Examination of Their Effects on the Adult Mind and an Account of Techniques Evolved and Employed. When scientists tested some of Hubbard's claims and found that his techniques produced no measurable improvement, he blamed them for failing to understand his system. Hubbard's rejection by the mental health establishment, even before Dianetics was published, was itself a kind of pre-birth trauma. After that, whenever Dianetics or Scientology was attacked in the press or by governments, Hubbard saw the hand of psychiatrists. The psychiatrist and his front groups operate straight out of the terrorist textbooks, he wrote bitterly years later. The mafia looks like a convention of Sunday school teachers compared to these terrorist groups. Toward the end of his life, he concluded that if psychiatrists had the power to torture and kill everyone, they would do so. Recognize them for what they are, psychotic criminals, and handle them accordingly. Psychiatry was the sole cause of decline in this universe. Hubbard set up schools to train auditors in major cities, which, along with the book sales and his lecture fees, generated a cascade of revenue. The money was just pouring in, Sarah marveled. Hubbard began carrying huge wads of cash around in his pocket. I remember going past a Lincoln dealer and admiring one of those big Lincolns they had then, Sarah recalled. He walked right in there and bought it for me, cash. The people who were drawn to Dianetics were young to middle-aged, white-collar Protestants who had a pronounced interest in science fiction. Some were motivated by the prospect of employment in this booming new field. Others were truth-seekers, often veterans of other movements and cults that were responding to the dislocations of the era. And then there were those who had heard the legend of the heroic Navy officer who had been blinded and crippled by the war, who had healed himself through Dianetic techniques. Like Hubbard, they sought a cure. Society and science had let them down. Through Dianetics, they hoped to be lifted up, enlightened, restored, and made whole. One of the contradictory features of Dianetics is the fact that Hubbard continually referred to the powers of clears, but as yet he had not actually produced a single one for inspection. Among other powers, a clear has complete recall of everything which has ever happened to him or anything he has ever studied. He does mental computations such as those of chess, for example, which a normal would do in half an hour, in 10 or 15 seconds. Such claims presumed that there was already a sizable population of Dianetic graduates with exceptional abilities, and Hubbard's readers naturally wondered where they were. In August 1950, Hubbard presented the world's first clear at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles. Sonia Bianca, a very nervous physics student from Boston, was brought to the stage. Hubbard claimed that through Dianetics, Bianca had attained full and perfect recall of every moment of her life. The audience began peppering her with questions, such as what she had had for breakfast 8 years before, or what was on page 122 of Hubbard's book, or even elemental formulas in physics, her area of specialty. She was incapable of responding when someone asked the color of Hubbard's necktie when he briefly had his back turned to her. It was a very public fiasco. Hubbard would not announce another clear for 16 years. One of his disillusioned acolytes later concluded that the concept of clearing was just a gimmick to dramatize the theory of Dianetics. The fact is that there were never any clears as he had described them, Helen O'Brien, Hubbard's top executive in the United States, wrote. There were randomly occurring remissions of psychosomatics. Meanwhile, his bigamous marriage to Sarah was careening toward a spectacular conclusion. A month after the Sonia Bianca debacle, Ron and Sarah were living at the Chateau Marmont in Hollywood. He was beating her regularly. With or without an argument, there'd be an upsurge of violence, Sarah recalled. The veins in his forehead would engorge, and he would strike her out of the blue. One time he broke her eardrum. And yet she stayed with him, a hostage to his needs. I felt so guilty about the fact that he was so psychologically damaged, Sarah said. I felt as though he had given so much to our country, and I couldn't even bring him peace of mind. I believed thoroughly that he was a man of great honor, had sacrificed his well-being to the country. It just never occurred to me he was a liar. Ron finally explained his dilemma. He didn't want to be married. I do not want to be an American husband, for I can buy my friends whenever I want them. But divorce would hurt his reputation. The solution? If Sarah really loved him, she should kill herself. Sarah took little Alexei, as she called their daughter, and moved into the Los Angeles Dianetics Research Foundation in a former governor's mansion near the University of Southern California campus. Soon after that, Sarah began an affair with another man, Miles Hollister. Hubbard furiously told his own lover, Barbara Clowden, that Sarah and Miles were plotting to have him committed to a mental institution. Indeed, Sarah had consulted a psychiatrist about Hubbard's condition. She told him that Ron had said he would rather kill her than let her leave him. The psychiatrist said that Hubbard probably needed to be institutionalized, and he warned Sarah that her life was in danger. Nonetheless, Sarah went directly to Ron and told him what the doctor had said. If he got treatment, she said, she would stay with him. Otherwise, she was going to leave. Ron responded by threatening to kill their child. "He didn't want her to be brought up by me because I was in league with the doctors," Sarah recalled in her deathbed tape. "He thought I had thrown in with the psychiatrists, with the devils." On the night of February 24, 1951, Sarah went to the movies and left her baby in the care of a young man named John Sanborn, who was studying at the Foundation. Alexis had become a kind of celebrity, or at least a curiosity. Hubbard had been touting her as the world's first Dianetic baby, shielded since birth against any engram-forming disruptions or parental conflict. As a result, Hubbard boasted, Alexis talked at 3 months, crawled at 4, and had no phobias. At about 10 o'clock, 11-month-old Alexis began crying in her crib, so Sanborn picked her up to comfort her. Suddenly, the infant said in a hoarse whisper, "Don't sleep." Sanborn was startled. He didn't think a baby could talk like that. "It went through me in a funny way," he later said, "the hair raising on the back of the neck type feeling." At 11 p.m., there was a knock on the door. One of Hubbard's aides appeared, wearing a top coat, with his hand in his pocket. Sanborn believed he was carrying a gun. The man said that Hubbard was here to take his daughter. Hubbard himself then came through the door, also wearing a top coat, with his hand in his right pocket. They took the child and disappeared. Later that night, Hubbard returned with two other men to abduct Sarah. "We have Alexis, and you'll never see her alive unless you come with us," Hubbard said. They tied her hands and dragged her out of bed into a waiting Lincoln. She says that Hubbard had her in a chokehold to keep her from screaming. Hubbard's assistant, Richard DeMille, son of the famous movie director and producer Cecil B. DeMille, drove aimlessly while Hubbard and Sarah, who was wearing only a nightgown, sat in back. She warned him that kidnapping was a capital offense. In San Bernardino, Hubbard ordered DeMille to stop at the county hospital so he could have Sarah committed. But it was the middle of the night and no doctor would talk to him. Eventually, Hubbard and Sarah negotiated a truce. Hubbard told her where Alexis was hidden. He had hired a nurse in West Los Angeles to watch her. And Sarah signed a note saying that she had gone with Hubbard of her own free will. Hubbard and DeMille went to the Yuma, Arizona airport and flew to Phoenix, while Sarah drove the Lincoln back to Los Angeles in her nightgown to pick up Alexis. When she arrived at the nursing center, however, she was told that a young couple had just left with the baby. Hubbard and DeMille flew on to Chicago, where Hubbard voluntarily presented himself for a psychological examination in order to counter the accusation that he was a paranoid schizophrenic. The psychologist administered some diagnostic tests, including Rorschach ink blots, and later provided a report that said that Hubbard was a creative individual who was upset by family problems and depressed about his work. Hubbard was extremely pleased. He would often mention that he had been given a clean bill of health by the psychological profession. Sarah remembered that he then called her and told her that he had killed Alexis. He said that he had cut her into little pieces and dropped the pieces in a river, and that he had seen little arms and legs floating down the river, and it was my fault. I'd done it because I'd left him, Sarah remembered. Hubbard and DeMille then traveled to Elizabeth, New Jersey, where the Dianetics Foundation had its headquarters. Meantime, the young couple that Hubbard had hired to abduct Alexis from the nursing center drove the infant all the way across the country to deliver her to Hubbard. It was the middle of March and snowing in New Jersey, so Hubbard decided to move on to Florida, where he intended to write his next book. DeMille came along with the baby. After a few days in Tampa, Hubbard still felt edgy and announced that the three of them were flying to Cuba. He believed that as long as he had the child, he could control the situation, DeMille told one of Hubbard's biographers. For 6 weeks, Sarah had searched for Alexis in Southern California, enlisting local police, sheriffs, and the FBI, but the authorities regarded the abduction as a domestic dispute. Finally, she filed a writ of habeas corpus, demanding Alexis's return, setting off a press uproar. On April 23, 1951, Sarah added to the sensation by finally filing for divorce in Los Angeles County, revealing that Hubbard was already married when they wed. She accused Hubbard of subjecting her to systematic torture, including sleep deprivation, beatings, strangulations, and scientific torture experiments. She said that she had consulted medical professionals who concluded that Hubbard was hopelessly insane and crazy. Soon afterward, Sarah received a surprising letter of support from Polly. "If I can help in any way, I'd like to. You must get Alexis in your custody. Ron is not normal. I had hoped that you could straighten him out. Your charges probably sound fantastic to the average person, but I've been through it. The beatings, threats on my life, all the sadistic traits you charge. 12 years of it. Please do believe I do so want to help you get Alexis." Meantime, in Havana, Hubbard hired a couple of women to take care of the baby. They kept her in a crib with wire over the top. To DeMille, it seemed that Alexis was being held like a monkey in a cage. Cuba was run by mobsters who had turned it into a hedonistic paradise, but Hubbard took little advantage of the nightlife. He locked himself in a hotel room, rented an old typewriter with Spanish language keys, and began to write. According to DeMille, Hubbard wrote all night with a bottle of rum at hand, which was empty in the morning. The book Hubbard was pounding out in Havana was Science of Survival. He introduced his readers to the tone scale, which had evolved since he sketched it out in his letter to Robert Heinlein 2 years before. The scale classifies emotional states starting at zero, body death. The lower tones are characterized by psychosis, where hatred and anger give way to perversion, artful lying, cowardice, withdrawal, and apathy. People below the 2.0 level, no matter their avowed intention, will bring death or injury to persons, things, and organizations around them, if in the anger bracket, or death to themselves, if in the apathy bracket, Hubbard writes. Anyone below 2.0 level is a potential suicide. Their bodies stink, as does their breath. At 2.5, there is a break point between the normal and the neurotic. This stage is characterized by boredom, vagueness, indifference, and pointless conversation. At level 3.0, one enters a stage that Hubbard characterizes as very high normal, where one is resistant to infections, tolerant, and reasonable. However, he is also insincere, careless, and untrustworthy. Clear registers 4.0 on the scale. A person who has attained this level is nearly accident-proof and immune to bacteria. He is exhilarated, eager, strong, able, curious, ethical, creative, courageous, responsible, and impossible to hypnotize. And yet this state is only one-tenth of what Hubbard forecasts in the realm of human potential. His scale goes all the way to 40.0. Serenity of beingness. But the capabilities of the upper regions are largely unknown. Given the circumstances that surrounded the creation of this book, it's interesting to read what Hubbard writes about sexual behavior and attitudes toward children. Not only was he on the run in Cuba with his abducted daughter when he wrote this, He was also being sued for non-support of the two children from his first marriage, whom he hadn't seen for years. "Sex," he wrote, "is an excellent index of the position of the pre-clear on the tone scale. The highest levels are characterized by monogamy, constancy, a pleasurable attitude toward sex, and an intense interest in children, although the urge to procreate is mitigated by the sublimation of sexual desire into pure creative thought. At 3.0 on the scale, sexual interest is diminished, but the urge to procreate remains high. That begins to fall off at 2.5, not for any reason beyond a general failure to be interested in anything. Children are tolerated, but there is little interest in their affairs. At 2.0, sex becomes revolting and children provoke anxiety. Rape and child abuse characterize 1.5.